This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran executes two men involved in a terrorist attack that left over a dozen people dead in the city of Shiraz last October. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination has urged France to fully investigate the recent killing of a teenager by the police. Also ahead, the United States says it will send cluster munitions to Ukraine as part of its military aid package. That's despite an international ban on the weapons. Our top story this hour: Iran has executed two men involved in a deadly terrorist attack on a holy shrine in the city of Shiraz, the capital of the southern Fars province. They were hanged before dawn on Saturday near the site of the attack. They had been convicted of being directly involved in masterminding the attack. The main perpetrator died in hospital from injuries sustained during the terrorist attack, which happened on October 26, 2022. The armed assailant had entered the shrine and opened fire on pilgrims inside, killing 13 people. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the attack. Daesh has also claimed earlier violence in Iran, including deadly twin attacks in Tehran in 2017 that targeted parliament and the Imam Khomeini shrine. Meanwhile, a terror attack on a police station in southeastern Iran has claimed the life of one law enforcement officer. The attack took place in Zahedan, the capital city of Sistan and Balochistan province. Some reports say two attackers set off their explosive belts, but a local security official says that four unidentified gunmen attacked the station using grenades. The situation is said to be under control now as security forces have surrounded the assailants. Zahedan has witnessed multiple terror attacks in recent years. The Pakistani government has declared Friday as the official day of the sanctity of the Holy Quran in protest at its desecration in Sweden. Demonstrations were held all over the country while Parliament passed a resolution urging the Swedish government to take legal action against the men who desecrated, against the man that is, who desecrated the Muslims' holy book. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
Tempers are flaring in Pakistan after the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Hundreds of Pakistanis marched in the streets across the country to honor the Muslim holy book.
They have given us a lot of pain by burning our holy book. We have always respected other religions.
The West, it claims to be the custodian of the entire world and says, you know, the values they set, they should be followed. I think that they are being a little hypocrite over here. Hypocrisy is prevailing in their societies.
Friday was marked as the day of sanctity of the Holy Quran with rallies and demonstrations held in all major cities of the country. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif called for the nationwide protests a week after a man desecrated a copy of the Muslim holy book Quran in Stockholm.
These outraged Pakistani people are not only expressing their support for collective measures by Muslim nations to prevent future desecration of the Holy Quran, but also demanding the end of such Islamophobic actions being carried out by some Western states.
The protest rallies were followed by a special joint session of the parliament. Lawmakers adopted a resolution condemning the desecration of the Quran and demanded that the Muslim world boycott those countries hurting the sentiments of the Muslims with such blasphemous acts.
The Islamic countries, the OIC, should now start putting embargoes on such countries who do not respect our Prophet, who do not respect our holy book. We should boycott them.
Addressing the special parliamentary session, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif demanded that the Scandinavian country must take practical measures against the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying that the mere condemnation was not enough.
Why did they let it happen? I think the Swedish government must answer this question and clarify its position. Islamophobia is being used as a tool to disrupt interfaith harmony and to incite Muslims against Christians and people of other faiths.
Islamabad has also urged the United Nations to convene a special session and invite Muslim world leaders to discuss the issue. That's another sign of gravity of the situation, not just for Pakistan, but Muslims worldwide. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign says the Palestinian people have no way but to intensify resistance against the Israeli regime, which is after cleansing, ethnic cleansing, all of them.
What's new is the public discourse. The killing has been the killing has been regular or irregular, repeated since 1948. This particular government's by no means the worst. It's simply the most shameless. In the past, Ben-Gurion and the so-called Labour Zionists have cloaked their ethnic cleansing, their mass murder, in truth words for their Western allies, in order to disguise what's going on. These guys today feel no need to disguise what they're doing. They're really blood mad, they're crazy, and they wish to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The Israeli army doesn't arrest Palestinians if they resist. It kills them. And if they have been members of the Palestinian resistance, then the Israelis would simply have killed them, because they don't want to arrest anybody whom they think they have fought back against the occupation army. This is a system based upon Jewish supremacy over non-Jews from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. And we're seeing a spike in the killing. The Palestinians know that they are doomed if they do not resist. Not just the refugees pushed into Gaza, but now in the West Bank and even inside 48, they increasingly know that their future is to be driven out. Because Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Netanyahu as well are sending signals to their political base that even those Palestinians who were trapped inside Israel in 48 have no future there, that they are tolerated until they can be removed. And of course, in the West Bank, we see helicopter gunships, we see missiles, drones and so on. We're beginning to see the Gazaization of the West Bank.
A UN committee has called on France to conduct a thorough and impartial investigation into the recent killing of a teenager by the police. The Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination says France should also adopt legislation that defines and prohibits racial profiling. The committee says it is concerned about racial profiling and the excessive use of force by the police against minority groups, especially people of African and Arab descent. According to the committee, the practice leads to recurrent killings with near impunity. It's also raised concerns about the mass arrests during the recent protests in France. They erupted after officers shot dead a 17-year-old citizen of African descent near Paris. The protests have seen thousands of arrests, most of them minors. The French Parliament has recently approved a justice reform bill that has created controversy. The law allows police to spy on suspects by remotely activating the camera, microphone, and GPS of their phones. The government says the law would affect only dozens of cases a year. The left and rights defenders, however, are critical of the legislation, calling it an authoritarian snooper's charter.
It has been described as an unprecedented restriction on people in France. Lawmakers have agreed that the country's police forces need to be allowed to spy on suspects by remotely activating the camera, microphone, and GPS of their phones and other devices. The measure agreed by lawmakers covers laptops, cars, and other connected objects, as well as phones. It further allows devices to be remotely activated to record sound and images of people allegedly suspected of terror offenses, as well as delinquency and organized crime. Rights activists have slammed the measure as, quote, an authoritarian snooper's charter. A digital rights group has slammed the provision, saying it raises serious concerns over infringements of fundamental liberties. La Quadrature du Net has called for the proposal as part of a, quote, slide into heavy-handed security. In early June, the French Senate, the upper house, approved a controversial provision to a justice bill that allowed law enforcement to eavesdrop on suspected terrorists and criminals using their devices.
The message from the top has generally been one to support the police and to reinforce their powers. And it has to be borne in mind that the police have faced some significant challenges, especially in the previous decade, where France was subjected to a series of terrorist attacks. And there was a fear that the police didn't have strong enough powers to contain that. And so some of those powers were reinforced.
France has been rocked by violent protests over the fatal shooting of a teenager by a police officer. The shooting took place in a Paris suburb more than a week ago. Thousands, including foreigners, have been arrested. Authorities are now considering putting restrictions on social media as part of measures to quell what they refer to as riots.
Moreover, senators approved the provision in the bill allowing law enforcement to track devices' location if the owner is suspected of committing a crime. The measures come amid unprecedented protests across France over the killing of a 17-year-old boy of Algerian origin by police in late June. Nahal's killing renewed old grievances regarding police brutality and racial profiling. It is estimated that some 3,400 to 4,000 people were arrested, which included more than 1,200 minors. Most of those arrested in the recent unrest had no previous criminal record. Meanwhile, there are concerns about restrictions on social media in France. France's digital minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, has announced that from August 25th, Paris will introduce mandatory measures censoring the work of social networks in the country. According to the French minister, President Macron had urged him to, quote, put maximum pressure on social networks. Barrot has also proposed to the Senate the creation of a working group to address measures to be taken in the event of mass protests and riots. Earlier, Macron claimed that protesters were using Snapchat, TikTok, and Telegram to film violent events and to organize illegal gatherings.
Enfin, les plateformes, les réseaux sociaux...
Social media platforms play a significant role in the events of the past few days. We have on several of them, Snapchat, TikTok, and several others, both the organization of violent gatherings and a form of mimicking of violence, which among the youngest leads to a feeling of unreality. It sometimes feels like some of them are experiencing in the streets the video games that have intoxicated them. And this, the law, including over the past few months, has set out changes to parent control that we want to be fully respected.
Macron has also discussed the possibility of banning access to certain social media features. Macron has told about 300 local leaders that the country needs to reflect on social media use among the youngest and on the prohibitions that must be put in place. Comments drew the ire of many critics.
These incidents just keep on happening, but this time it was captured on video, and that's why people are fuming. But Macron goes to his Elton John concert, and then he blames video games for the protests. Video games! Maybe his police officers play too many video games, and that's why they pulled out their guns on a 17-year-old without a driver's license. And one of them said, I'm going to put a bullet in your head. Macron now wants to ban sensitive content on social media because it's embarrassing for him. But dare Iran ban Twitter or Egypt cut off the internet, then Macron and the West will spring into their usual chorus of that's censorship and that's a dictatorship, no freedom of speech.
The French government has been accused of conducting attacks on migrants, racial profiling, and religious intolerance. The police killing has tapped into the long, festering resentment of police brutality among many French minorities and have rekindled a long, painful debate about racial profiling by police.
Great masses of people in the Iranian capital of Tehran have marked Eid al-Ghadir by attending the 10-kilometer-long party, which has been hailed as the world's largest celebration event of its kind. Farzana Shuryon has more.
The world's largest Ghadir celebration. In the Iranian capital of Tehran, a 10-kilometer route was lined with more than 1,200 stations to celebrate Eid al-Ghadir. The streets were decorated with green flags and other decorative elements as part of the celebrations. The route was filled with people from all walks of life.
Millions of Iranians all across the country celebrate Eid al-Ghadir. People from all walks of life celebrate this day together out in the streets.
Today is Eid al-Ghadir, which is one of our biggest days. We have brought our children to get them familiar with the Eid al-Ghadir celebration. This is a happy day and good things are happening today. Our children should learn about Eid al-Ghadir from a young age.
Children are also a main part of the massive rally. They say they have joined the 10-kilometer walk for the love of Imam Ali. Families also take the opportunity of Eid al-Ghadir to introduce the teachings of Imam Ali to their children.
We are here because of our love for our supreme leader and Imam Ali. We love Iran and Imam Ali.
I want to know Imam Ali because he was a good man. We want our children to know about Imam Ali and follow his path.
Today I'm here with my daughter, Maryam, and my wife. I've brought my daughter here to mark Eid al-Ghadir together.
On this day, different programs and events, such as musical performances and plays, are carried out, and food and drinks are distributed as a part of the massive celebration. The celebration ends with fireworks as a reminder of the brilliance of this significant day. Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
That report brings an end to World News for this hour. Thank you for staying with us.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, MPs in the House of Commons have said the public health service is getting worse day by day, and they have also warned about a tidal wave of child mental ill health in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK ministers have been charged with failing to grasp the tidal wave of mental ill health blighting children's lives, after research found that only a quarter of English primaries will be able to offer vital school-based support by the end of next year. With almost one in five pupils aged between 7 and 16 now thought to have a mental health disorder, specialist support teams were set up to work with children in schools, addressing early symptoms and reducing pressure on overstretched NHS services. According to new figures shared exclusively with The Guardian, pupils in almost three-quarters of primary schools in England will have had no access to the new mental health support teams by the end of 2024. According to figures obtained by the Liberal Democrats, older pupils fare slightly better, with the mental health support teams expected to be in place in about half of secondary schools by the end of 2024. The government is yet to confirm future funding plans. The research follows reports that a quarter of a million children in the United Kingdom with mental health problems have been denied help by the NHS, with some trusts failing to offer treatment to 60% of those referred by GPs. The former Children's Commissioner for England, Anne Longford, said, "These shocking figures show the scale of the crisis in unmet mental health need that our children are now facing." And Longfield added, "Poor mental health, self-harm and in some cases suicide have become part and parcel of growing up for many children, yet children's mental health services are unable to meet the overwhelming demand." Mental health support teams were widely welcomed when first announced by the government back in 2018, promising early intervention in a school-based setting for children aged between 5 and 18, with mild to moderate mental health problems before they develop into a crisis. School leaders say the mental health support teams are having a positive effect, but the rollout has not gone fast enough or far enough, leaving tens of thousands of children without adequate support either in school or from child and adolescent mental health services. There are also concerns that the teams are struggling to meet the needs of children with more complex conditions, who do not reach the high threshold set for a child and adolescent mental health service referral, but need more support than the mental health support teams can offer. The Liberal Democrats sent Freedom of Information requests to every NHS Integrated Care Board in England, asking for details about the mental health support teams already operating in their area or due to be operational by the end of 2024. 31 of the 42 Integrated Care Boards responded with data. The responses revealed a huge postcode lottery in the rollout and wide geographical variation in spending per pupil on the mental health support teams, ranging from £87 in the area covered by NHS Surrey Heartlands Integrated Care Board down to £24 in North East and North Cumbria Integrated Care Board and £34 in Hertfordshire and West Essex. The Liberal Democrats' education spokesperson, Munira Wilson, said, "The government is letting down our children and young people. Our children's mental health services were in crisis before the pandemic, but Conservative ministers have failed completely to grasp the scale of the tidal wave in mental ill health that has emerged since." Munira Wilson added, "Under the Tories, a school that sees an NHS mental health professional for a day a week is one of the lucky ones. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of children are left waiting to see if mental health support will be rolled out at their school or sacrificed to pay for the government's economic incompetence. Yet failing to roll out the programme will simply make waiting times for acute child and adolescent mental health services even worse." website Noledia has also covered the same story and tells us more. The UK's Liberal Democrats' data shows in some areas mental health support teams do not cover secondary schools at all. Data for Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly shows that the mental health support teams cover only primary schools, with a remit to prioritise pupils in reception year and in the transition into Year 7. But even then, only 47% of primary schools in the area are covered. Surrey Heartlands Integrated Care Board, which covers most of the country, operates the mental health services team in 4 out of 10 secondary schools, but in fewer than 1 in 10 primary schools. 4 more mental health services teams are due to become operational by the end of next year. The Liberal Democrats say Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire and West Berkshire Integrated Care Board have seen the slowest rollouts, with existing or planned teams covering just 1 in 5 secondary schools and 1 in 10 primary schools. According to the government, the rollout of the mental health support teams is ahead of schedule, and it has promised to increase the number from nearly 400 in April of 2023, covering 35% of pupils and learners in England, to more than 500, covering about 44% by the same time next year. Barnardo's, which delivers 12 mental health support teams across England, launched a petition earlier this year calling on the government to roll out mental health support teams to cover every school and college throughout England. The charity's senior policy advisor, Becky Rice, said, "Children of all ages across both primary and secondary schools are struggling with their mental health. It is not just something which is impacting those in their teenage years." Becky Rice added, "We need to ensure children of all ages struggling with issues such as low mood, anxiety or emotional regulation get the help and support to manage so they are able to happily progress through the rest of their childhood years without reaching a crisis point. Schools are dealing with growing numbers of children with special educational needs." Government data published recently showed that the number of children with education, health and care plans in 2023 rose to 517,000, 9% more than last year. Margaret Mulholland, a special needs and inclusion specialist at the Association of College and School and College Leaders, said, "There is a growing mental health crisis among children and young people in England. Mental health support teams can have a really positive impact in tackling this, but not all schools are currently able to access these services. The scheme must be rolled out to all parts of the country as soon as possible to ensure that all children and all young people are able to benefit from it." A government spokesperson claimed, "These teams represent just one of the ways we're supporting school children's mental health, and come on top of our annual £2.3 billion investment into mental health services. This means an additional 345,000 children and young people will be able to access the NHS-funded mental health support that they need."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has killed 3 more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This comes just in the wake of unprecedented raids and aerial attacks in recent days on the Jenin refugee camp, which left at least a dozen Palestinians dead. In retaliation, Palestinians have carried out some operations against Israeli forces, and the resistance movement Hamas and Islamic Jihad have vowed to take revenge and continue resistance until the liberation of the occupied territories. A group of UN experts have warned that Israel's latest attacks on the Jenin refugee camp could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. But will these words by international bodies ever translate into any concrete action and stop Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians? Joining us on Spotlight, we have Elijah Magni, a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. And also we have Khalid Barakat, spokesperson of the Masar Badil movement, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magni in Brussels. We know that the Israeli regime has increased its deadly acts of aggression against Palestinians since late December 2022. Just today, three more Palestinians were killed. That follows the large-scale assault earlier in the week on the Jenin refugee camp, which killed another 12 Palestinians. Mr. Magni, give us your perspective on this heavy escalation of violence by the Israelis.
Thank you for having me. It is obvious that this is an operation just to support Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who faces a very turmoil domestically, where many people don't want him, the people don't want his government to continue, particularly with the very far-right extremist members like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir controlling the government. And this is how he managed to shut down all the protests against him and unite the front, the opposition, and those with him, behind him, when it is regarding the attack against the Palestinian. Secondly, we understand that his main objective, the second main objective, is the exodus of the Palestinian. So we've seen between 3,000 and 4,000 Palestinian who fled the Jenin camp, that are between 14 and 17,000 only. We have seen how he destroyed the infrastructure. So he went for destructing the water, the electricity, the internet, the landline communication. This is not an attack to hunt particular identity or individual, but it is to destroy the camp and make it impossible to live for the civilians. So the objective of Israel is exactly what Benjamin Netanyahu has done in the Jenin camp, and he continued to do, for a simple reason, that he's not accountable. The international community supports him. The only thing that the West is saying that they are concerned, we've heard how the European ambassador, who said nothing about the attack against the Jenin camp, but spoke on the first occasion when there was an attack against the Israeli gathering in Tel Aviv. So all the indignation from the West comes whatever the Palestinians react, which is their full right, according to the UN Charter, to be the resistance and to resist against the occupation forces, that they're not even behaving as occupation forces, because occupation forces should behave by bringing construction to the country and construction to the inhabitant, to the original inhabitant, while what they do is just to push the Palestinian outside their own country.
Khalid Barakat, a group of UN experts has warned that the scope of Israel's latest aerial and ground attacks on the Jenin refugee camp may constitute war crimes, and the attacks constitute collective punishment of the Palestinian population. In your perspective, what was the motive behind the Jenin raid by the Israelis?
Well, obviously, the aggression against Jenin was to uproot the Palestinian resistance from the camp in order to achieve a Israeli political objective, and that is annexing the West Bank. That's what Israel wants. At the end, they want the land, and they cannot fully control the land and build colonies with the Palestinian resistance that is growing by the day in the West Bank. So Israel finds itself also in a mid of an internal crisis, and they try to export this internal crisis at the expense of the Palestinian people by not just aggression against the Jenin and the city and the camp, but also across the West Bank. Now, in terms of war crimes and United Nations reports, we have seen this so many times, countless times of United Nations viewing what Israel is doing is a war crimes. I mean, building colonies in an occupied land is a war crime. Displacing Palestinians from their own homeland is a war crime. The siege on Gaza is a war crime. And we know that Israel is finding a lot of difficulties in dealing with the growing resistance in the West Bank. We have said before the aggression that this is going to be a failure and the Palestinian resistance is going to come victorious out from this battle. And now, Palestinians feel that before this aggression is not like after the Jenin battle. Today, the Palestinian resistance is putting a platform that it is very important for Palestinians to escalate their resistance confronting Israeli war crimes. And these Israeli colonies are going to be a very difficult project. It's not going to be an easy one from now on, as the Palestinian resistance is focusing on accumulating more strength and at the same time knowing exactly where, when, and the objectives of any of their military operations. Now, President Ibrahim Raisi was very correct when he said that this aggression reminds Palestinians of the 1948 Nakba, because that's exactly what happened, where Zionist gangs and criminals attacked Palestinian villages and towns, and they were displacing Palestinians. Now, they do that all the time. And in the case of Gaza, for example, that it's under siege for 17 years, they can blockade Gaza and make it difficult for people to rebuild. In the case of the West Bank, I think Israel is going to find the difficulty to do that, and Palestinians immediately got engaged in the rebuilding process.
Elijah Magni, analysts believe the fact that Israeli forces are now targeting Palestinian civilians is a sign that the regime is becoming weaker in the face of the resistance. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, I think the objective of Benjamin Netanyahu in the illegal attack against Jenin camp did not reach its objectives. Therefore, we've seen a failure because the Palestinians, first of all, are becoming stronger. Second, they are united in one operational room. Third, the young generation is picking up more than expected, and it is determined to return the land. And fourth, we've seen the retaliation from the Palestinian every time there is a terrorist Israeli attack against them to uproot them, as your guest rightly said, from the West Bank and from Jerusalem and other parts of Palestine. So all these objectives have failed. This is why we've seen the Israelis just doing these small operations for a couple of days for domestic use. But because the international community is silent, and because they can do whatever they do, they can get away with it. However, internally, every time we've seen the Israelis attacking the Palestinian, we have seen a retaliation. We have seen retaliation from Gaza. We've seen retaliation from Lebanon. We've seen retaliation from the Islamic Jihad. We've seen it retaliation from all over Palestine. So yes, the new generation, the new Palestinian generation, is more driven to liberate this land, and this is what caused the failure of all the Israeli plan to try to curb the Palestinian will and to submit them.
Khaled Barakat, talking about the Palestinian retaliation and resistance, Hamas has hailed the resistance against the recent Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp as being a victory in a statement. The Qassam Brigades, that's the military arm of Hamas, described it as a great victory. It emphasized that Jenin and other occupied cities will remain focal points to inflict painful blows to the enemy. Will the growing Palestinian capabilities now pose a major challenge for Tel Aviv? In other words, should the Israelis start to feel less safe now?
Absolutely, and not just in the West Bank and the colonies in the West Bank, but all over Palestine, from the river to the sea. The Palestinian resistance have absolute right to retaliate anywhere in Palestine. And now the equations have changed. There is a direct relationship between the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, the West Bank, and occupied Palestine 48. There is a camp of resistance in the region that is also accumulating more strength, and the coordination in a united front is not just, you know, in theories and in political terms and statements, but in actual programs that is being implemented on the ground, particularly with the support of the Lebanese resistance. Now, we also have to say that this is a Palestinian popular path. It's not just the Palestinian resistance faction. This is a resistance supported by the vast majority of the Palestinian people in Palestine and in diaspora. And the vast majority of Palestinians today, even in elections, when you go do, you know, student elections or labor elections in Palestine, the pro-resistance, slates, you win massively these elections, which indicates that the Palestinian people are sick and tired of this futile path of so-called negotiations that has been going on for the past 30 years. They see that their land is being confiscated and stolen by the, you know, the Israeli Zionist regime and settlers who comes from Berlin and London and New York to settle in Palestine, and they're armed criminal Zionist settlers who comes to the West Bank and to Palestine in general carrying guns. And not just that, some of them have actually training in U.S. Army and in Canadian Army and in European armies. And that's why we always say that the Palestinian resistance have the right to target any settler in Palestine, anywhere in Palestine, from the river to the sea, because they're all paramilitary and mercenaries who comes to Palestine to to massacre the Palestinian people and to steal their land and to build a racist, apartheid, colonialist system in the heart of the Arab and Muslim world. And that's why also Palestinians see themselves that they're not alone, and they are being supported by a very strong camp in the region led by Iran and by the Lebanese resistance and the Palestinian resistance. And this is the path of the Arab people now. And we see that. We see the mass demonstrations and support that Palestinians are also seeing from Algeria to Yemen to Lebanon to Syria to Jordan. The Arab masses are expressing also their support for the Palestinian resistance. And this is very important after we witnessed 12 years of chaos and wars and sectarian wars that imperialist power was pushing in the region. Also, this sure. Palestinian victory comes negotiations and political new relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and we think that this is important and it helps Palestine.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Elijah Magni on that same issue. Are the Israelis, in your opinion, worried about a united Palestinian resistance front, especially now that the Palestinians have shown what a united resistance front is capable of?
Of course it is worried, because we have seen always limited operation against the Palestinians, and we have seen how the Israeli government is trying to avoid a long war, afraid of the participation of other front, particularly when Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon all expressed their readiness to participate into the attack against the Israelis if the resistance in Palestine demand and requires their intervention. This is why the Israelis are always extremely afraid, particularly in the light of seeing how the axis of the resistance that is formed from all those countries that I just mentioned, is in control of advanced missiles, advanced weapons, drones. We've seen Iran declaring its possession of new hypersonic missiles that can hit Israel anywhere. Hezbollah is capable of hitting any target in Israel and any area in Israel. We've seen how Hamas bombed Israel for many days non-stop with hundreds of missiles and rockets. We've seen the Islamic Jihad, that is a very good, small group, managed to hold on against the Israelis for several days in the first and the second, and the last two attacks against the Islamic Jihad. So all that is, the equation is changing. The Israelis used to be the strongest army in the Middle East. That is true. However, opposing the Israelis, the resistance was weak. Today, the resistance has acquired a different level of weaponry, intelligence gathering, electronic warfare, missiles and drones, capable of facing Israel and hurting the Israelis. And this is why the Israelis are afraid of widening any attack in the future, because they are concerned about a united front, and because they are concerned about multiple fronts starting against the Israelis, when we have seen the Israelis incapable of maintaining the bombing of Gaza itself or the attack on the Islamic Jihad only. So yes, there is a big difference, and we've seen how the axis of the resistance is managing to impose deterrence on Israel.
Khaled Barakat, talking about the impunity of the Israelis. Hamas has said the silence of the international community emboldens Israel to continue its aggression. Hezbollah's Seyed Hassan Aslo has said the world turning a blind eye to the Israeli killing of women and children is alarming. And the UN's very own human rights chief, Volker Turk, said, quote, "For the violence to end, the occupation must end." Why is that not happening?
Because of the United States of America. The United States fully support Israel politically, militarily. They provide them with $4 billion a year of military assistance. They cover Israeli crimes in international scene. The United States, Britain, Germany, their Palestinian blood are on their hands, because Israel is their project, and they don't deal with Israel as just a friendly state of them. It's their actual project that they support in the heart of the Arab and Muslim world. And that is, the goal is to divide the people of the region and to conquer the region and to weaken any real renaissance of the people of the region and of West Asia. Now, the United States is doing this because they are serving their own imperialist and colonialist interests. But let me just give you an example of how things changed on the ground in Palestine. In 2002, when Israel launched its aggression against the Jenin camp, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the general secretary of Hezbollah, then offered the Israelis to release the Zionist soldiers and general Hezbollah had captured, and Israel refused, because at that time the balance of power was in the interest of Israel and of Sharon Mufaz coalition. So they continued their operation against the camp, and they destroyed the entire camp. Now, and in these days, after 20 years, they couldn't do that. And not because the Palestinian resistance in the camp is more stronger, but because the balance of power in the region and in the world is changing. And at the same time, Israel is not the same anymore. Israel is deteriorating from inside. It's a corrupted regime. We began to see that the surplus power that Israel enjoys, they cannot use it against the Palestinian people. It's basically useless. And, we see how Israel is shifting more and more towards becoming a fascist, society, not just a state. And they're basically, as they are divided, the Palestinian people are united. And that's how things are changing on the ground.
And one last thought in from Mr. Elijah Magni. How do you explain the Western mainstream media silence regarding events in the occupied territories?
Well, we have seen Joseph Borrell coming out and giving us in Brussels a communique saying strongly that Israel killed 150 civilians last year. But what he has done, nothing. After reading communique and expressing his concern, this is what he has done. He just closed the document and then walked away. So how can we expect the mainstream media that is controlled by the Israelis, that nobody dares to express any criticism of Israel? The BBC did that a couple of days ago with an interview with the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, and there was a big scandal how the BBC can dares to ask why the Israelis are killing civilians and children. So there is a full control of mainstream media. There is a general attitude to close an eye on what the Israelis are doing. And there is a general understanding that Israel is like the American. They are not accountable for any crime they committed. This is therefore we do not expect from neither the mainstream media nor all the Western officials to do anything against Israel.
Very well. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Elijah Magni joining us from Brussels. Mr. Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thank you for contributing to our program, and also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means
to... Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though, we learn.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what role does contemplation play when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and leveling up our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear listeners, it's great to be here with you talking about ubudiyah. So, in today's program, we really want to talk about what role contemplation plays when it comes to increasing, strengthening, and leveling up our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, you know, as you know, and as we all know, we live in a very fast-paced world. Technological advancement, scientific advancement, seems like everything has become mechanized, everything is mechanical. We are surrounded by machines. And what's interesting is machines themselves don't really have souls or spirits. And so this being surrounded by objects which don't have a soul or a spirit, these things have a sort of an impact and an effect on us. I dare say that it, you know, being surrounded by these spiritless objects kind of makes us move in the same direction. Over the passing of time and days and months and years, it slowly starts to turn us into a machine. Even though it's kind of a side note and a tangent, but it's not bad to talk about, I think, because it does have an effect on our ubudiyah. And that is the role of social media and the electronic devices that we use. And these things do have an effect on our ubudiyah, and I think it's appropriate that we will, inshallah, talk about this on a different program. But kind of coming back so that we don't digress, we live in this age where, yes, we are surrounded by spiritless objects, and this does have an effect on us. Now, one of the attributes or one of the qualities of this world that we live in, as we said, is this fast-paced, you know, it's almost like a blur. You wake